Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems' monthly podcast on recent developments that impact the public safety workplace. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so, depending upon how long things go. You never quite know for sure. I've got a bit of an ambitious agenda for this podcast. I've got some real significant cases that I want to talk to you about, including our first cell phone privacy case, where we have an employer that seized an employee's personal cell phone. And, of course, constitutional litigation followed. And I do want to talk about those cases. I also recently recorded for Marion University a bit of a webinar on, they asked me to address what I thought to be the top five mistakes that employers made in the internal affairs process. And I thought that I'd go over what my list was. We talk about that just a little bit. But the first thing I want to talk about is some continued prognostication as to what the impact of the election is going to be, because there have now been some developments on that front. And the big development that we're seeing may be that the Supreme Court's 1985 decision in Garcia versus San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority is at risk. So what's Garcia, and why is this important in the public safety workplace? The Fair Labor Standards Act has been with us a long, long time. It was enacted in 1938. But when it was written, it didn't apply to public sector employers. It wasn't until the mid-1960s that Congress acted to first apply the FLSA to any public sector employers, and it really did so with a vigor in about 1973. A group of employers got together and challenged whether or not Congress had the authority to apply the FLSA to state and local governmental bodies. It's a constitutional issue, and the question is whether or not Congress's power under what's known as the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution trumps the states' rights provisions of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And the Supreme Court, the first time it addressed the issue, held by a pretty comfortable margin, it was a 6-3 margin, that the commerce power won, and Congress did have the authority to apply the FLSA to state and local governmental bodies. Then the political complexion of the Supreme Court changed, and a few years later, in a case that had the title of National League of Cities, the Supreme Court changed its mind. And the Supreme Court in League of Cities held that the states' rights provisions of the 10th Amendment, in fact, superseded Congress's commerce power, the power to regulate interstate commerce. And, of course, wages are an integral element of interstate commerce. League of Cities stayed on the books until 1985. And in 1985, the Supreme Court addressed the issue for the third time in about 10 years, and the Supreme Court changed its mind again and went back to its first position. By a 5-4 margin, close vote, the Supreme Court held that Congress did have the authority to impose the FLSA on state and local governmental bodies. It was a very tough litigated case, and there's a very aggressive dissenting opinion from then Chief Justice William Rehnquist. William Rehnquist was a very conservative justice. Justice Rehnquist ended his dissent, and I'm sort of making up these words, but I'll bet it's pretty close to an exact quote. He ended his dissenting opinion after complaining about the court applying the FLSA to states and local governments. He ended his opinion by noting that the political complexion of the country might be changing, and it would not be too long before the court would once again resume the correct constitutional path. What's the English language translation of that? I can see into the future. Republicans are going to be controlling the White House and Congress, and they're going to appoint judges who think like me, and states' rights will once again prevail. Well, that prediction turned out to be not very immediately realized. Garcia, after all, is a 1985 decision of the Supreme Court. That's 31 years ago now. The Supreme Court has decided several public sector cases since Garcia, and in some of them, employers have argued that Garcia should be overturned. The Supreme Court turned very, very conservative, but in spite of all that, it never seized upon the opportunity to even address the continuing vitality of Garcia. But what's going on right now is that you have employer groups, national employer groups, that are figuratively rubbing their hands together at the notion of President Trump having certainly one appointment to the Supreme Court, the position that Antonin Scalia held before he died in February, certainly one appointment, and maybe as many as three or four. And they are already publicly teeing up the notion that it's time to get Garcia reversed. In fact, when you saw the challenge filed by state governments to the Department of Labor's new regulations on who's exempt and who's not exempt under the FLSA, when you saw that challenge, this group of 21 states, led by the state of Texas, actually put as a central argument that it was time to overrule Garcia. The trial court judge didn't buy it and held the regulations unconstitutional for a different reason. But nonetheless, it's clear the argument is out there. It's going to be made by employers. And I am guessing that sooner or later, the Supreme Court is going to revisit Garcia. What will it mean if Garcia is overturned? It will mean that state and local governmental bodies will no longer be subject to the overtime provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So all of these lawsuits that we've seen all over the years since Garcia, lawsuits for off-the-clock time where police and fire have been suing for uncompensated work that they were ordered to perform, these lawsuits we've seen on who's exempt and who's not exempt, these lawsuits that we've seen on who has control over comp time or how you calculate the overtime rate, they would all be a thing of the past. And the matter of overtime would be left to local law and, if it existed, collective bargaining. So this is one, there's nothing like immediately on the horizon where we can say for certain that this is the case where the Supreme Court might overturn Garcia. Maybe the closest thing that's out there is the Flores case I talked about a couple of months ago that involved whether in lieu of health insurance payments needed to be included in the regular rate. That may be the closest available case. That's still about a year out from the Supreme Court. But keep your eyes open for this. We are going to see some fundamental changes in labor law principles. That is becoming crystal clear as the administration of President-elect Trump is being formed. We're going to see some fundamental changes. And the question is, how far those changes will go. We know what direction they're going to go. They're going to go in favor of employers and away from employees. We just don't know how far. Okay, let's talk cell phones. We have our first post-Riley cell phone decision. What do I mean by post-Riley? A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court decided a criminal law case called Riley versus California. And in the case, the court had to decide whether or not cell phones had special protection under the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment, of course, is the search and seizure clause of the Constitution. It has a couple of requirements, a requirement that searches and seizures be based upon probable cause, and also that they be pursuant to a warrant, except for some very narrow exceptions. Riley was a criminal law case, and in the case, the Supreme Court held by one of its rare 9-0 margins, the Supreme Court held that cell phones are different than other kinds of property for Fourth Amendment purposes. They're different in the sense that they are the electronic equivalent of what might have been 20 years ago our photographic albums, our bank records, our mail, our correspondence. As the Supreme Court put it in Riley, cell phones contain the most intimate details of our private lives. And thus, said the court, cell phones are treated differently than other property under the Fourth Amendment. And the way they're treated differently is that the government, when the government is acting, must have a warrant and probable cause to get into a cell phone. Now, once Riley came down, there were a lot of people talking about how would Riley apply in the employment setting. Because after all, public safety officers in this this country are almost all employed by the government, states and government and local governmental bodies. So how would Riley apply? And I heard a lot of predictions about that, read a lot. There were a lot of blog posts on the whole issue, and I certainly weighed in. And I think most of us who were thinking about this issue were predicting, first of all, that Riley would apply, and it would apply in a setting where an employer conducting a disciplinary investigation wanted to get access to the employee's personal cell phone. We predicted it would apply, and we also predicted that what would likely be the rule would be that the employer would have to have reasonable suspicion, not probable cause, because in an employment setting you tend to see the lower reasonable suspicion standard. The employer would have to have reasonable suspicion that the cell phone was used as an instrument of rule breaking. Somehow the use of the cell phone violated the employer's rules. And we also predicted that if the employer was going to get into an employee's cell phone, if it had that reasonable suspicion, it would have to limit its examination of the cell phone to the type of records that would have been involved in the misconduct. So let me give you an example. Let's say the allegation of misconduct is sexual harassment, and the allegation is that one firefighter sent a sexually harassing text message on October 21st to another firefighter. What that would mean would be that if the employer had reasonable suspicion that that behavior occurred, the employer could get into the employee's cell phone, but only for the purpose of looking at text messages sent on October 21st. Couldn't look at photographs, couldn't look at emails, couldn't look at financial records. The search would have to be as narrow as possible. That's a basic Fourth Amendment principle that applies really across the board. So those are all the predictions that we're making, and they were predictions that were made in a blessed ignorance of any case law, because there wasn't any case law on it. But now we have our first case, and it is thanks to Timothy Larios, who is or was an officer with the California Highway Patrol. Larios was assigned to an interagency narcotics task force. He was given a cell phone by CHP, and he also had a personal cell phone. CHP in 2014 starts an investigation into Larios, tells him he's the subject of an internal affairs investigation, and during the course of the investigation, he was ordered to relinquish his state-issued phone. Parenthetically, no problem there, right? If it's the employer's equipment and the employer does what like 99.9% of employers do and warns the employee that they have no expectation of privacy in the use of the equipment, the employer can seize the equipment and examine any messages or phone records or whatever contained in that equipment. We know that from another Supreme Court case longer ago involving the city of Ontario, California. So no problem that the employer ordered Larios to relinquish his state-issued phone. If the case stopped there, I'd have nothing to talk about. It didn't. A month or so later, Larios met with a lieutenant and others involved in the internal affairs investigation. The lieutenant had told Larios, hey, you don't need a union rep present, but Larios decided he knew better and brought his own union rep, and they quickly learned that the purpose of the meeting was for CHP to confiscate Larios's personal cell phone. Larios refused to give it up on the ground that it contained personal information. CHP then orders Larios to turn over its phone so it could, and here are the words it used, conduct a data extraction to retrieve all work product. The memo that was sent to Larios also told him he'd be subject to disciplinary action if he failed to cooperate. Larios still objects to the order. He offers to voluntarily show the investigators any and all work products stored on his phone. The investigators say no and told Larios his phone would only be confiscated for 3 to 4 hours. Larios, who's worried that he might be subject to criminal prosecution if he fails to obey the instructions, eventually relinquishes his phone. Turns out CHP didn't have it for 3 to 4 hours. It had it for 8 hours. And when Larios got it back, he noticed that personal phone calls had been made from the device and that all of the information stored on the phone had been searched and downloaded. CHP eventually fires Larios. He sues. He raises all sorts of claims under California's Bill of Rights and other constitutional claims. The one that I think we really care about the most is he claims that his Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable search and seizure had been violated by CHP's treatment of his personal phone. CHP files a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, and a federal court then has to decide whether Larios had Fourth Amendment privacy interests in the phone. And the court sides with Larios. The court ends up saying that Larios maintained a reasonable expectation of privacy in his password-protected personal cell phone. And that expectation of privacy existed, and I'm quoting, despite Larios having used it for work at times with the permission of his employer, and even in the face of notice that any work product would have to be turned over to the state. Knowing that work product would remain open to inspection in no way puts an employee on notice that the government will also have carte blanche to review everything an employee keeps on his or her cell phones. And the court goes on to talk about, what I think of as the analog comparison. That's what the Supreme Court did in Riley, right? It was making an analog comparison to photograph albums and bank records and correspondence. And that's exactly what this court does, and its decision, not coincidentally, turns on Riley. The court said, look, if we buy CHP's argument here, that somehow putting work files on this phone opens the whole phone up to inspection, that's an argument that we think goes too far. Because if you take that argument to its logical conclusion, keeping work files at home would permit the government to search an employee's house. And certainly employees have a legitimate expectation of privacy in their homes, and as the court puts it here, their interest in the contents of their cell phones is not materially different. In fact, says the court, a cell phone search would typically expose to the government far more than the most exhaustive search of a house. A phone not only contains in digital form many sensitive records previously found in the home. It also contains a broad array of private information never found in a home in any form, unless the phone is. So, what does the court do with the case? The court goes on to analyze whether or not CHP's search of the phone was reasonable. Remember, first half of the case is there an expectation of privacy? And the court finds that there is. The court then says, look, as to whether or not the search is reasonable, well, that would ordinarily be a matter that would be subject to trial, but here, Larios has alleged the CHP searched everything on the phone. If that's true, says the court, if Larios is able to prove that at trial, CHP clearly overstepped the bounds of the Fourth Amendment. So it sends the case back down to trial. So what does all this mean? I think what this case suggests to us is that the advice that people are giving, and put me on that bandwagon, it's advice I'm giving, that employees should have two phones and not one, an employer-issued phone and an employee-owned phone, that advice is really sound. I think, even though Larios ended up winning on the issue, I think employees would be well served to have an absolute rule. I am never going to do company business on my personal phone, and I'm never going to do personal business on my company phone. And let there never be an overlap. And I think that's the way this litigation is going to eventually shape up. And there's a lot more of these cases out there in the pipeline. Now let's veer into that short little presentation I did for Marion University on what I thought to be the top five employer mistakes in the internal affairs process. This, by the way, was not my idea, but I love it. I love the notion of asking a union side lawyer what the top five mistakes are that an employer makes, and that my understanding is they're going to ask an employer lawyer as to what the top five mistakes a union makes in the internal affairs process. And I think that's just a wonderful perspective to get. By the way, I've got some slides on this, and if you want to download the slides, it's easy to do. What you have to do is, I'm going to give you a text code now. Text the code 657-281 to the number 44222. Once again, text 657-281 to the number 44222. And you can pick up, that's only a 8-slide presentation. And go figure, right? I've got the top five mistakes and I have 8 slides. That's a lawyer for you. All right. So what's mistake number one? And by the way, just to set the stage here, I've read a lot of internal affairs investigations in my life. I'm certainly not exaggerating in saying I've read tens of thousands of pages of transcripts. And I've been in a lot of internal affairs investigations representing employees. So that's the basis for all of my comments here. Okay, mistake one that an employer makes in the IA process, not having a plan. I think what the investigator needs to do is to develop a plan long before starting the first interview. The plan should cover some basics, potential witnesses, interview order, where's the interview going to be held, location, timing. Plan needs to involve the review of all potentially applicable employer rules. So you look through the entire code of conduct and review other regulations that might somehow bear on the allegations in the complaint. And just because you're reviewing them doesn't mean you have to charge employees with violations of those rules. Arbitrators, civil service boards hate it when employers overcharge, when they kind of leaf through their rule books, and borrowing a little bit here from Elizabeth Barrett Browning, say something like, how can I charge thee? Let me count the ways. But you do need to review all the rules to decide which are the core rules that do apply to a particular set of factual allegations. The plan also ought to cover the preservation of physical and electronic evidence. It may well be that there are some purging rules that the employer generally has that would apply to both physical and electronic evidence, particularly with respect to video evidence. The internal affairs investigator needs to make sure that they know in advance what those purging rules are so that evidence doesn't accidentally get deleted. The plan should also include notifications to everybody who needs to be notified, the complainant, potential witnesses, the employee, the union. Make sure all those notifications are done in a timely fashion. And then also, as part of making up the plan, the investigator needs to review the union contract, if there is one. Find out what rules are in place governing investigations. And you can't do that too much. You can't just assume, oh, I know what it is. It's always helpful to go back and skim what the union contract has to say. If you're in a state that has a public safety bill of rights, whether it's a police or a firefighter bill of rights, review that Bill of Rights because it's going to have strictures as to how an investigation is conducted and the timeliness of an investigation. Once you've got that plan in place, be flexible about it. Don't rigidly adhere to it. It may well be, it likely will be, that you'll need to amend the plan depending upon what you're learning in the course of doing the investigation. But you can't amend the plan unless you have one in the first place. And don't just simply assume because you've done 10 or 100 internal investigations in the past that you don't need to sit down with a computer or, heaven forbid, a piece of paper and sketch out a complete plan for doing your investigation. Okay, that's mistake number one, not having a good plan. Number two, asking bad questions. This is the one, if you pick one that's going to irritate union side lawyers the most and simultaneously delight union side lawyers the most, it's an internal affairs investigator asking bad questions. Why will it irritate us? It irritates us because it tends to turn internal affairs investigations into very one-sided affairs. Why does it delight union side lawyers? Because it makes for wonderful cross-examination of the IA investigator if the matter eventually ends up in a hearing. So what are the biggest offenders in terms of bad questions? Number one, leading questions. What's the definition of a leading question? We all have one sort of in the back of our heads, but it tends to be slightly wrong. Sometimes we think of a leading question as one that only allows the answer yes or no. In fact, a leading question is really broader than that. A leading question is one that suggests the particular answer or contains the information that the investigator is looking to get confirmed. So contrast these two questions. Contrast, first of all, a non-leading question. Where were you on the night of March 15th? Now contrast that with a leading question. Were you at home on the night of March 15th? The second one contains the information the investigator is looking to have confirmed. Leading questions are what we think of as closed questions. They demand short, controlled answers. Not all controlled, short answers are bad, but an interviewer gets much more information by asking open questions, such as, what happened next? Or where were you on the night of March 15th? Leading questions aren't going to do much good in getting at the actual facts of an incident. What's the second biggest offender in terms of bad questions? Compound questions. Compound questions are one that touch on two or more topics, but only allow one answer. So, for example, in a police context, did you see both suspects on the corner of Broadway and Main at 10:15 p.m.? Well, that actually, that question involves three subjects, right? It involves whether or not there were one or two or more suspects. It involves where the suspects were they at Broadway at Main? And it also involves the time. That's a classic compound question. Here's a good rule of thumb. If your question takes longer than three transcript lines, or maybe even two transcript lines, it's likely going to be a compound question. And I've seen some compound questions that are breathtaking. I've seen one question, this is my record, or at least the one that I can think of, I've seen one question that lasted 2.5 pages of transcript, where the internal affairs investigator was just loading up question after question after question. Is the answer to that question going to do any good? And in fact, if the employee and the union rep are trained, and they'll carefully listen to that question, and if there is the tiniest little bit of that question that is incorrect, that 2.5 page question, the answer is going to be no. And then the investigator is going to have to regroup. So avoid compound questions. Third category of bad questions, speculative questions. Speculative questions don't elicit facts, but they ask for a witness to give an opinion or to speculate. So, for example, how do you think the suspect felt when you used the control hold? Well, how would anybody know the answer to that question? You can ask witnesses to give estimates. Make sure you specify that in your question. But asking them to speculate, really a lot of trouble. And a particularly difficult area, asking the witness to provide an assessment of somebody else's state of mind. You just simply can't do it. All right, so that's mistake number two, asking bad questions. Mistake number three, writing bad summaries. I would guess that the majority of the summaries that I have read of internal investigation interviews, the majority that I've read are not good summaries. Summaries need to be complete, they need to be non-biased, and they need to be a recapitulation of an interview or the investigation. Who's ever writing the summary needs to keep in mind that people who are reviewing the investigation may only read the summary. They may not look at the transcripts of interviews, if there are even transcripts of interviews. They may not look at the police reports or, you know, a memo through the chain of command for in a fire department. They may not look at any of the investigatory materials other than the summary. And it's for that reason that summaries have to be very, very well done. Summaries should quote and not paraphrase witnesses on key points, particularly whatever employee is the subject of the investigation, and particularly on that employee's intent in doing a particular act. Where have I seen summaries fall down? I've seen them fall down on both of those key points. I've seen summaries frequently that are incomplete, that do not cover all of the key facts. Summaries should include both inculpatory and exculpatory information. They need to include all of the salient points. And I've also seen them fall down on that other key element, of not being neutral. Time after time, it's very, very clear that an investigator has made up her or his mind as to what happened, and the summaries will be written with that perspective. Can't happen. Shouldn't happen. And it makes for a bad internal investigation, and it certainly makes for fodder if you get into a hearing. Mistake number four that I've seen made is not being flexible. It's particularly with an interview. It's okay to have an outline for your interview. In fact, it should be mandatory to have an outline for the interview. But the outline is just a guide, and the interviewer needs to make sure that they allow the interview to develop organically, that they follow leads, and that they just simply let the interview flow. Those are going to be the best interviews. You can always go back to the outline at the conclusion of the interview and make sure that you've covered all of the points. Should you write out your questions? Well, I'll speak now as a trial lawyer. I never write out questions. If you write out questions, what you end up doing is getting locked into those questions too much. I'll have an outline every single time. I'll have an outline, whether it's direct examination or cross-examination, but I'll never write out questions. If you do so, you're going to be too rigid. You're not going to do the most complete interview possible. Mistake number five is not being neutral in your investigation. Investigators aren't prosecutors. They're not defense attorneys. They're not trying to prove the employee's guilt or innocence. They should be trying to do one thing, and that is gathering all the relevant facts and presenting them through the chain of command. That means investigators should be following all evidentiary leads, and they should be gathering all of the evidence, whether it proves the employee engaged in misconduct or disproves whether or not the employee engaged in misconduct. It's the investigator's job to gather evidence that bears on both. So, those are my list of the top five mistakes. No doubt other people in my shoes might add to that list or have different elements to that list, but it's a pretty good list, I think, to refer to if you're about to start on an investigation. A list under the heading of things you shouldn't do. Next up is a Brady-type case that I guarantee will scare you to death if you're involved in law enforcement. And it's a case that comes out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal appeals court that's on the west coast of the United States. And I still shake my head when I read this case. I find it hard to believe that this is the right result. So this is a case that involves a detective sergeant with the Seaside, Oregon Police Department. That's a small town in Oregon. I'll bet it probably has 15, 20 officers, something like that. And this sergeant's name is Stephen Barnett. Barnett ran for sheriff in his county. It's called Clatsop County. And while the race was ongoing, a article was published, written by the local DA. His name is Josh Marquis. He's quite a character and has quite a reputation in Oregon. And Marquis endorsed Barnett's opponent for sheriff. That was published in, as I mentioned, the local newspaper. It's called the Daily Historian. It's published in Astoria, Oregon. Barnett wasn't going to take that lying down, so he wrote an article responding to Marquis. I've read the article. It wasn't a terribly unprofessional article or anything like that. It was just simply, you know, part of a normal political race. And after the publication of the article, Marquis informs the Seaside Police Department that he objected to Barnett's article. In other words, he's trying to get him fired. And in the following month, Marquis informed the police department that the DA's office would no longer, his words, vouch for the credibility of Barnett. and stated that the DA's office would no longer accept cases in which Barnett was a witness. Barnett lost the election, eventually retired, and retired because of, in part, the pressures on his employment caused by Marquis. And then Barnett sued Marquis, contending that the DA's office had never filed any perjury charges against Barnett, had never challenged his certification to work as a peace officer, never given him anything remotely close to due process, and in fact was retaliating against him for his First Amendment rights, his rights to engage in political activity. A federal trial court dismissed the lawsuit on the grounds that even if everything that Barnett said was true, even if this was a pure act of political retaliation, that Marquis couldn't be sued under the doctrine of absolute prosecutorial immunity. Barnett then appealed that case to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit upheld the dismissal of his lawsuit. I'm going to read you about four or five lines from the Ninth Circuit's opinion so you get a feeling for how broad this principle is of absolute prosecutorial immunity. The court says, prosecutors are absolutely immune from a lawsuit under the Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act for prosecutorial conduct, which is intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process. Prosecutorial conduct includes initiating a prosecution and presenting the state's case. As a result, actions taken outside the courtroom and preliminary to trial can be protected by absolute immunity, and a prosecutor's conduct need not be related to a particular trial to be protected. Here we go. A prosecutor's decisions about witness credibility and the presentation of evidence are intimately associated with the judicial phase of prosecution and are therefore protected by absolute immunity. The accuracy of a prosecutor's witness credibility assessment is immaterial even if that judgment is harsh, unfair, or clouded by personal animus. So, in dismissing this lawsuit, what the Ninth Circuit is saying is that even if Marquis was motivated solely by political revenge, he cannot be sued for destroying Barnett's career by retaliating against Barnett for writing a letter to the editor or an article in the paper. That's pretty amazing. And it's for this reason that you've seen police unions, police officers, not just unions. This has been supported by management in some states, notably California and Maryland, get passed state statutes that say that simple placement on a Brady list without proof of underlying dishonesty can't be the basis for discharging a police officer. And this is sort of ultimate placement on a Brady list. Now, I'm going to Monday morning quarterback this one just for a little bit. Did Barnett have another option here? Maybe. You know, there's that recent New Hampshire case from the New Hampshire Supreme Court. I've talked about it in a podcast, I think about this time last year, in which a couple of officers who were placed on a Brady list, wrongly placed on a Brady list by a prosecutor, didn't sue the prosecutor in federal court, didn't sue him under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act, instead filed a lawsuit in state court, and they didn't look for damages. What they looked for was a decision that they needed to be taken off of the Brady list. And the New Hampshire Supreme Court, exercising its role as the supreme judicial authority in the state, ordered the DA to take them off of the Brady list. Is that something Barnett maybe could have considered? I think so. But he went a different route. He went through the Civil Rights Act looking for damages. I get it. He was retired, and getting off the Brady list probably wouldn't matter all that much to him. So there might be an opening here. But still, this case gives you, I think, a very good feel for the tremendous breadth of the notion of prosecutorial immunity. Absolute immunity means you can't be sued, no matter what your motivation is, no matter how impure your motivation, you can't be sued if you have absolute immunity. And that's what the court said applied to prevent Barnett from suing in this case. I want to end with a really good analysis from California's Public Employment Relations Board of the duty to exchange information about a grievance. This is a firefighter case, and it deals with an issue that I think comes up with some frequency. So here's what happened here, the facts of the case. It involves a battalion chief by the name of Stephanie Radicke. She worked for Alameda County, or works for Alameda County, California. Radicke did not get along with two other employees. Unfortunately for her, one of them was outranked her, a division chief by the name of Dan Benfield. And you probably get a pretty good idea of what's going to happen when I tell you the other person she didn't get along with was Benfield's wife, a captain named Amanda Benfield, who was a subordinate of Radicke. Well, Radicke files a complaint alleging that the Benfields are acting in concert to retaliate against her for filing complaints in the past. The fire chief, very understandably, decides we need to get a third-party investigator in, and they hire an attorney. They hire a local attorney to do a workplace investigation. Not to be outdone, Captain Benfield, that's Amanda, files a complaint against Radicke, alleging that Radicke had created a hostile work environment by yelling and swearing at her and sharing confidential information by disclosing a summary of a meeting that she had on her grievance, her, meaning Radicke's grievance, alleging that the Benfields had been retaliating. So all of this mess gets dumped in the lap of the attorney who's hired to investigate it. And after the completion of the investigation, the department rejects Radicke's charges and reprimands her based on Amanda Benfield's complaint. The IAFF local, it's Local 55, hires an attorney who requests a copy of the outside investigator's report. The department says, no, you can't have the report, and both Benfields object to the release of the report. And that leads Local 55 to file an unfair labor practice complaint with California's Public Employment Relations Board. What's the issue? Well, the duty to bargain in good faith, which is imposed by state law usually, sometimes by local ordinances, the duty to bargain in good faith includes the obligation to share information that's relevant to the bargaining process. So if there's information that's relevant to something that's mandatory for bargaining, wage, hour, or working condition, and either side has it, the other side can request it, and the party in possession of the information has to disclose it. There's some very, very limited exceptions to that, but the general rule is a principle of broad disclosure. We're going to get all this stuff out on the table and make sure both sides are working from the same set of facts. That duty to exchange information relevant to the bargaining process specifically does apply to grievances. And so this is why in some cases you see instances where a union challenging grievance, say for a 5-day suspension for insubordination, the union requests all prior disciplinary action for insubordination. And the employer has to turn that information over, has to turn those disciplinary records over. That's why, because it's relevant to the grievance, and the grievance is, of course, part of the bargaining process. So those are the broad principles that California's PERB has to apply in the Radeke's case. And the case ends up not with the full PERB, but with an administrative law judge. And the ALJ starts by enumerating a number of the principles that I've just gone over, that if information is relevant to some sort of grievance, it has to be turned over, and it has to be turned over as part of the grievance processing system, and has to be turned over particularly even if you get to arbitration. What did the department argue here? The department argued that there were privacy interests in the investigation, and that it had other interests, an interest in promoting candor in investigations, and an interest in preventing retaliation against participants in investigations, and that all of those interests, privacy, candor, and preventing retaliation, they outweighed Local 55's interests in seeing the investigation. And the administrative law judge says, sorry, I'm not buying it. It's true, we'll apply a balancing test when there's a privacy interest that is asserted on the part of the employer pursuant when it receives an information request. We'll balance why it is some other employee might have some privacy rights, and we'll talk about what we can do about that. You know, you can always black out names as or redact particular testimony if you've got a demonstrable privacy interest. But here, says the ALJ, I don't even get there. And I'm going to quote a couple lines from his opinion. The department made no offer of accommodation to Local 55 at the time of the request and didn't offer the report for in-camera inspection. The department didn't offer the reasoning and analysis of the investigator as to why witness names shouldn't be disclosed or portions of their statements shouldn't be disclosed. We don't even know if the report contained witness statements from third parties other than the three principals who were involved. And also, the administrative law judge is, I think, pretty deeply skeptical that the Benfields really are afraid of retaliation. After all, says the ALJ, one Benfield, Captain Benfield, actually filed her own grievance against Radeke, and that resulted in a reprimand of Radeke. She's clearly not intimidated by Radeke. And so, in the end, says the administrative law judge, I don't think that anything in this material is exempt from disclosure. We're going to have to see a provable threat to another employee or public safety for an investigative report like this not to be disclosed, and we don't have anything like that here. Turn over the report. And that, by the way, I think is going to be the general rule pretty much anywhere you are. This isn't a California-specific rule. The whole idea is if you disclose information, fully disclose information relevant to grievances, there's a better chance the grievance will settle and that you won't have to end up at the ultimate stage of arbitration. So with that, I'm going to wrap up our last podcast of what's been a pretty amazing year, 2016, with LRIS. Hope to see you at one of our seminars. We have a seminar in February that we're putting on in Las Vegas on union leadership, and we have one in April that is one that we invite everybody to, employers and unions, on collective bargaining for public safety employees. And boy, are we going to be in an interesting bargaining year. No question about that. Hope to see you at one of those seminars. You can go to our webpage at LRIS.com and check in with what's going on there. And with that, have a great holiday season, and hope to see you in January for the next edition of First Thursday.